Hello and welcome to episode 51 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. It's Who Done It? The Commentary. I'm Jerry Shario, and in the past we've answered questions about many things in this podcast. But the one question we will not tackle is, how do you solve a problem like Nick Santamaria?
You know, I'm even at a loss with that one. But it's funny that you say that, because I used to sing that when I was a kid. I actually thought it was funny that, you know, how do you solve a problem like Nick Santamaria? Unfortunately, most of my teachers sang the same song. And I'm just going to say very quickly that Jerry had some troubles with his internet at home, and now he is in the library doing this. So we go to great lengths to bring you this wonderful entertainment. Jerry, thank you for going the extra mile.
So we No problem. I'm just happy we could actually get this recorded.
It's been a while. I won't mention what's going on with me at home, but it's been a very tragic time, and I'm trying to get through it. And that's why there were delays. So please forgive me for that. And let's, whenever you're ready, Jerry, I'm ready.
Okay, as usual, we're going to, as usual. The last time we did this, we started the movie at the original Universal logo, not the colorful new one that they stick on the beginning. So that's where we're going to start. So cue up your DVD, Blu-ray, 16 millimeter film, whatever you're watching it on.
Illegal and streaming.
Yeah, any of the above. No questions asked. You know, we're not here to judge. And so
a judge in Miracle on 34th Street.
This is true. This is true. I am not a judge, but I've played one on Broadway. So I'll give you the countdown. It'll be 3, 2, 1, push. And we will watch the movie together with running commentary. Okay, here we go. 3, 2, 1, push.
And there is my all-time favorite movie logo.
Oh, I know.
Over the MGM Lion, over the 20th Century Fox searchlights, over the Warner Shield, over the woman holding two enormous globes in front of her breasts. I forget what company that was. Worldwide. Now, look at this. Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, right?
Yep.
You've got the silhouettes that look like them. And, of course, they were so big at this time that they wouldn't be caught dead doing this. And speaking of dead, somebody just got killed in silhouette. And now the boys are running. And it looks like they're on a treadmill with the backgrounds going, you know, past. And I'm thinking that the guy in front, the one who looks like Lou, is probably Pat Costello, who doubled for his brother. And the other one is Bud's double. You know, they wouldn't be doing this.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, whatchamacallit, we're looking at some great names here. Charles Van Anger is one of their great DPs, and this movie looks just beautiful. It could be a film noir. That's how beautiful it is. There's Alex Gottlieb, their producer, and Earl C. Kenton, their director, who directed their earliest films. And let's face it, did a wonderful, wonderful job. But the funny thing about Earl Kenton is that he directed what I consider to be the most horrific of the classic horror movies. And that was Island of Lost Souls, which I can't watch anymore because it's so horrifying, you know, cutting open people without ether or, you know, vivisection and all that stuff. It's just really horrifying. But anyway, let's go to this wonderful, delightful comedy.
Yeah, let's talk about a murder instead. Why don't we?
Murder at midnight. Okay, so we've got our, I just want to mention that we are replacing the horrible, horrible commentary supplied by a comedian I usually like, Frank Conniff, rhymes with Goniff, actually built himself as a film historian and did what is definitely, not possibly, definitely the worst commentary I've ever heard on a film. So we are going to correct that now, because he disappointed so many Abbott and Costello fans who was they were looking forward, including me, to the background on this film. So thank you, Frank, for being so lame. So we're doing it. We are now at a radio station, GBS, George Bernard Shaw. And
yes.
In this movie, Bud tries to get Lou to be a gentleman so he could pass him off at a party and be insane. Oh, no, wait a minute. That's George Bernard Shaw. That's Pygmalion. All right. So let's catch up with this movie. There's Louise Albritton, who is just absolutely gorgeous in a very almost modern looking way. Don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
She almost passed for a modern day actress. And there's Jerome Cowan and Ludwig Stossel. Playing Dr. Merrick. Now, Jerome Cowan, a very familiar face during the late 30s into the 40s, 50s. He was even in the Three Stooges' first feature with Curly Joe, the Have Rocket Will Travel. And there's Patrick Knowles, who I will tell you a quick story about, but we'll get to that. Jerome Cowan on Broadway appeared with Alan Jocelyn. I don't know if you remember Alan Jocelyn, another great character guy who reminds me of Jerome Cowan, actually. But the two of them made their bones in a play called Boy Meets Girl on Broadway. It was made as a movie at Warner Brothers in 1938, but they replaced those two guys with James Cagney and Pat O'Brien. And you know what? It doesn't work. They're trying too hard to be the Ritz brothers, and it just doesn't work. I would have loved to have seen Jerome Cowan and Alan Jocelyn, who were probably wonderful. So anyway, we get Jerome Cowan here. He actually played some leads during the war years when, you know, everybody was out, you know, fighting Germans and Japs. I use the vernacular of the wartime years.
Yes.
Jerome Cowan got to play a detective in these B movie, you know, detective movies at Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. Now, Jerome, the story here is, and I'm sure you're well aware of it if you're a fan of this film, and who isn't, Colonel Andrews is kind of based on General David Sarnoff, the head of NBC, and of course RCA. You know, he's played as a lovable guy, Thomas Gomez, the great character actor. There he is. And Gomez is definitely playing older. You can see the graying makeup in his hair and the little mustache. But Louise Albritton is an old friend of the Patrick Knowles character. They know each other. And did I just miss my favorite line in the movie? I would teach for the rest of my natural born days before I would take a handout from a woman. This is the Lindbergh thing. And this, if you don't, you know, somebody wrote something really awful in the comments, just saying that, you know, oh, I really enjoyed the podcast, but I can't stand Lou Costello. And it hit me like, you know, like a needle in the heart. And it's like, what? How can you not love Lou Costello? But, you know, it's the same thing with Jerry Lewis. I know people that absolutely love Jerry Lewis. And I last night I tried to watch some of him and I had to turn it off. I was so annoyed. So I understand. I get it. But one of the top critics in New York said that if Lou Costello can find something new in a Limburger cheese bit, the man is a genius. And I couldn't agree more. This was supposed to be Bud saying he wants a Limburger cheese sandwich. And then you cut to Lou walking into the scene with the gas mask on. And that was it.
Oh.
That's all it was supposed to be.
No.
At the genius of Lou Costello, who turned this into a set piece and is one of the funniest things he ever did, as far as I'm concerned. The man don't want a ham sandwich. Bud is so good in this movie.
Yeah.
He's so on, isn't he, Jar?
Oh yeah, he really is. And to me, the gas mask is a funny bit, you know, especially like right here now where they pull it off and he's got a clothespin on his nose. But it benefits from all of the business with slicing the cheese itself.
Absolutely.
It makes it an even funny, it's the topper on a routine.
Yeah, yeah. And he's putting pressure on him, you know, which makes it even funnier.
Yep.
Okay. Now we have Walter Tetley. And I have a lot of people wanting to know about Walter Tetley. Now, Walter Tetley was a pretty fascinating guy. I mean, He was born in 1915, which means he was 28 years old when he made this movie. Look at him. He looks like he's 16. He looks like he's 15.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we know him from, if you love The Great Gildersleeve, he was Leroy, the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show. He was Julius Abruzzo. And most famously, he was Sherman in Mr. Peabody on the show. But he never grew taller than like 5 feet, and his voice never changed. And some people were under the impression that he was accidentally castrated at birth, so that never developed, or that he had this disease. I forget what it was called, but you know, that just kept him from developing or even getting to puberty. So he was kind of a tragic character. There was an auto accident later on. He was wheelchair bound, and he never really recovered from that. And he died when he was like 60 years old. But he was amazing, and he had that incredible voice. And I love the way he teases Lou in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Walter teases him all through the movie. And that's the derivation of Tetley tease, I imagine. You know, I've been waiting to say that joke all day.
Couldn't have waited a little longer, huh?
So Bud and Lou, Mervyn Milgram, and Chick Young. No, Chick Young, he was Abbott and Costello and Frankenstein. What is he, Chick? I forget his last name in this. Excuse me.
Close enough.
Yeah. All right, so they're kissing up to these two guys. Patrick Knowles is invited to see Murder at Midnight, the recording of their big show across the street. And Mary Wicks, the great Mary Wicks, plays the secretary to Colonel Andrews, the head of the whole shebang. They don't know what they put in the malted milk. But Bud and Lou right now are going to demonstrate the very first example of reality radio rather than reality TV. They want to play two detectives, Muck and Meyer. Small fry. Oh, boy. They're demonstrating, you know, for the professionals who are, you know, placating them and listening to them.
Yeah.
So Bud and Lou are just ad-libbing all over the place. This movie is like an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. There's no script. It's just when you worked with Bud and Lou, you got on board, you learned how to do it, or else you didn't do it. That's all there was to it. And it's one of the reasons I love their movies so much. They're just out of control. So they are trying to sell their idea. They're actually enjoying themselves, Mary Wicks and Patrick Knowles. I'm holding the gun backwards. I love that. Crime doesn't pay, and neither did she. See, I love that Patrick Knowles becomes their friend, and he's going to help them out. Depreciate it. I'd sure depreciate it. So Patrick Knowles, I've said this before, our podcast number 10 is Whodunit, and it's got almost 3,000 listeners on YouTube alone.
Nice.
Very popular movie.
Oh, yeah.
Look at him. That's a wartime joke. Sugar was rationed. So he just has sugar tied to a string, and he just dips it into his coffee. Hey, Chick, throw me an egg. And I love that you see the shadow of the hand throwing the egg. You actually see it, but it doesn't matter. It still works.
No.
And Lou giving his little click of his voice. So here they are showing up at the radio studio to watch Murder at Midnight. And Walter Tetley is trying to get his girlfriends in, and he can't. You don't have tickets. Now get out of the way, Walter. Go away. Go grow up somewhere. So who comes up? The prime sucker of all time, Lou Costello, Mervyn Milgram. Now, I promised I would name my next pet Mervyn Milgram, but It turned out to be so unpopular with my family, who didn't want to yell, Marvin. So we named him something else. We named him Chappie. But anyway, here he is tricking Lou out of the tickets, Walter Tetley, and trying to convince him that those are yesterday's tickets. Hey, Chick. Certainly not. So Lou throws them away. Walter Tetley picks up the tickets immediately and takes his girlfriends in to the radio show. Okay.
Yeah.
And now Walter's going to become Bud Abbott for a moment. If you were a little bit smaller, I'd take a punch at you. He's going to pay him now. Give me two dimes for a nickel. This is two tens for a five.
Yep.
Which they did in One Night in the Tropics. Only 2 years earlier. Just went south. Okay. He's no match for Walter Tetley in this movie. I love it. The little kid who's 28 years old. What are you talking about? Certainly. And now he's going to try it on. Chick. Here's two dimes. Give me a nickel. Ha ha. He did it to me. And you did it to me too. Look at the change of expression. Anyone who doesn't think that Lou Costello was a genius comic artist, watch this movie, and then we'll talk.
Hey, so there's Joker. Joe Kirk.
Joe's, Lou's brother-in-law, married to his sister Marie. And I think Joe is very good in this movie. And I'm going to point out one scene where Bud and Lou are working him over as detectives. They're pretending to be detectives. And it looks like he's like almost biting his lip. You know there were earlier where he just broke up. Because they're right in his face. Okay, so now they notice Juliet, who is Mary Wicks. And one of my favorite jokes is, so what? She's only got a couple of buck teeth. I don't care what you paid for them. a joke I used to use on Broadway in Greece during my pre-show, my ad-lib pre-show. I used to use that joke, but I thought I wrote it. I thought it was mine. I'm serious. It's so weird. But this was planted in my brain when I was like 5 years old, you know, watching this movie. So, okay, this is kind of important. Her name is Juliet, and Lou has to play up to her. And, of course, he says, I'll be your Romeo. See, that was dubbed. And they cut out the fact that she was angry, and she calls him a wolf. You see her say it very clearly, but they wanted to avoid that. They wanted to avoid that attitude from her because there were more scenes with her coming up and all that. So I don't know. I don't know. All right. So Bud finds a way in and they're getting into the studio. And this is very important. Lou doesn't see that it's a glass door and, of course, walks right into it. Okay. So the boys are inside. Everybody's there. Patrick Knowles, look how happy he is to see them. I love this. Is she pretty? Now watch Patrick Knowles here. Watch how much fun he's having. He's loving this. And he truthfully was loving this.
Yep.
He loved working with them. Although he was so afraid when he got this job, he actually told somebody, and it got back to Lou. And Lou got Bud in on it. So they did their best to make him feel comfortable. You know, so during their first scene together, Lou yelled, cut. How can you put this guy with an accent with me? I don't know what the hell he's talking about. What are you doing to me? And of course, the whole set starts laughing. Bud gets involved. And that relaxed him. Now, look at this. The woman's job is to scream into the microphone. And that reminds us of Joan Davis in Hold That Ghost, who was a professional radio screamer. All right, that's, what's his name? Edmund, oh God, I forget his name already. Edmund McDonald.
Murder
at midnight. Now, it's weird. I was watching for some reason, I was watching Great Guns with Laurel and Hardy, one of their worst later mm-hmm. films. And I've seen that movie 100 times since I was a kid. And I had no idea that it was him. Edmund McDonald played the sergeant in Great Guns. He didn't have a mustache. Yep. And he didn't play this character, you know. So I never knew it was him. Okay, Colonel Andrews turns on the microphone and he gets like 3,000 volts through him and he dies. He's electrocuted. And we want to know who done it. Look at the shadows. Watch the shadows in this scene. It's gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. Charles Van Anger, his photography is just gorgeous. Robert Boyle's art direction is just fantastic. I got to meet Robert Boyle at the Academy of Motion Pictures back in the early 2000s or whatever. He's still around. And what a nice guy. What a wonderful guy. He worked with everybody. Okay. So Patrick Knowles is there, and he notices that it's murder. Look at all the close-ups. The lighting. Murder. 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 Now watch this. Lou does a solo on the organ with his butt. This is like really cheeky when you think about it. Ooh. Look at that. On fire. He's out of control. Wonderful. Climbing over the desk. I mean, yep. God, look at him. Call the cops. Call the cops. Call the cops. Call the cops. And Bud, I love that Bud takes the reins, you know? It's like, no, we're going to solve this. And if we solve this, we'll get our radio show and everything will be great. Certainly not. Reality radio. Chick Larkin and Mervyn Milgram now playing Alcatraz. Rigor mortis. Okay. Watch Bud. Claps his hand, gracefully steps up on the stage. Lou claps his hand, jumps up, and does this incredible pratfall. And I used to do that very same fall in a show I used to do called Mental Floss. And it was improv. So sometimes you had to go out into the lobby so you didn't hear the setup. And then when you came back, you had to guess what was going on. That was one of the games we played. So every time I would come in from the lobby to jump onto the stage, I would do that same Lou Costello fall. And it always got a laugh. Here they are dealing with Don Porter. Don Porter, who I remember mostly as a kid, I remember he was the father of Gidget, Sally Field, in that mm-hmm. sitcom, that early 1960s sitcom. One of my earliest TV memories. So I always knew him from that show, and I always liked him in that show. And then I saw this movie, and I was like, oh my God, he's a murderer. Oops, I just blew it. I just gave it away. Sorry.
Quite honestly, if anybody is actually listening to this episode and has not seen this movie before, they deserve it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think you're speculating here. Okay, so Patrick Knowles is aware that they are not really detectives, but he's going to play along with them because he's so cool. He's such a great guy. I used to talk to Patrick Knowles once a week. Now, I know that sounds weird. You know, why would you talk to Patrick Knowles once a week? Just to find out who done it. No. I used to work for – when I first moved to Los Angeles from the East Coast, I was 19 years old. And, of course, you needed a day job. If you were in show business and you wanted to get ahead, you had to have a sustainable – you know, Jerry. So mine was – I got a job at Ames Home Loan. It was a mortgage company. And to be honest with you, I kind of charmed my way in and had no idea what I was doing. It was like a Kramer on Seinfeld situation. I had no idea what my job was. So immediately I just started filing, which was easy. I answered the phones, which was really nice. I was like the secretary to a loan officer, a woman who liked me. She actually liked me. And so I got away with so much. And then one day, after about 2 years, I was called into the office and they actually asked me, do you know what you're doing? And I had to tell them, no, I don't. I'm sorry. But I do walk around the office and I make them laugh and I stop at desk and I, you know, I get a lot of laughs. I said, doesn't my boosting their morale, doesn't that, you know, mean anything to you? But anyway, I got away with it for a little while longer and that was that. Okay, so watch this. Lou is trying to solve the case. Now I want you to watch Joe Kirk. Look at how straight he is. He's watching his brother-in-law. Now watch, look at his face. He's almost smiling. And you know that two takes before this, he was laughing. watching his brother-in-law just be a lunatic. Now, I do want to comment on Louise Albritton, who just seems like she's not having fun at all. maybe she just never was able to adjust to the way the stars worked, you know? But she was already, she already worked with Olson and Johnson at this point. There's Norman Abbott, Bud's nephew, who was also the creepy organ player. So look at this. It's OJ, before OJ, the glove.
Yes.
And it fits Lou. So I think Lou actually killed Nicole and the waiter. I don't know. It's just a guess on my part. That's terrible. So anyway, Bud and Lou are on the job. Now they have the glove that is incriminating to the killer, which means they are going to be pursued by the killer themselves. But watch Lou's fall here. I mean, that hurt his butt. That hurt his butt. I definitely guarantee it. I grew up doing falls like this and on stage, on Broadway, and it hurts. Okay, now here's Walter Tetley again. Tetley T's. For half a buck, he'll squeal. And he squeals. See, I think the reaction is funnier than the joke itself.
Oh, yeah.
As they're watching. He had no enemies. Maybe his friends. He had no friends. Well, maybe he was murdered by strangers. He had to have strangers. Okay, the knife. I love the sound effect. Zdoom. And then Lou jumping out of his shoes. And watch where he puts the hat. Oh, no wonder he had a heart condition.
Gosh.
Honestly, he's just out of control. Okay, our second comedy team walks in, and that's William Gargan, who had just appeared in Keep 'Em Flyin' with the boys, and the wonderful William Bendix. Come on! He's doing his New York dumb character.
Yep.
Now there's a famous story told by Robert Lees, who pretty much lied about everything, but he claims that Lou was in the screening rooms watching dailies and yelling at the screen, "Don't you hire people funnier than me? Why did you hire William Bendix?" You know, just really being a jerk about it. And none of it was true. Bill Bendix was his best friend in Hollywood. And Lou never went to the dailies. It holds no water. And speaking of holding water, here they are at the water fountain, and Lou can't get a drink. Now this whole scene was supposed to be just Lou doing this, but it became such a scene between the two of them improvising. It became like a longer bit and a funnier bit. And this bit, I think more than any other in the movie, got the most attention in the reviews. They Lou sneaking up on the water fountain, hoping the water doesn't see him.
Yeah.
And Bud encouraging him, go ahead, take what you like of it. Go ahead. And I love how when Bud gets it. Yay, look at him. They're having so much fun. They're having so much fun in this movie. Now, Bud gets it again. I love this. This is very Oliver Hardy. He tries to get, you know, try to get Stan into some situation. It always turns around on Ollie. That's what Bud just went through. Okay. This is one of my favorite things in the whole movie. So Lou is sitting there. Okay. The Gargan and Bendix, the new comedy team, are grilling everybody. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Colonel Andrews was an expert at code, especially in the First World War. So the government came to him this time, because this is World War II, of course, and he was supposed to be uncovering the code for the government. Now, the doctor, Dr. Merrick, Ludwig Stossel, he is also in on it. He knew about the whole FBI connection and everything. Boy, nobody likes Jerome Cowan. And Bill Bendix is always in the way. I like the derby on Bill Bendix. It looks good on him. Poor William Gargan. I remember when I was a kid, there would be commercials of him with throat cancer, warning everyone against smoking. You know, it was a very heroic thing to do. And he became a good spokesman for that. And didn't last much longer, actually, unfortunately. Oh, I love this. Jerome Cowan, man. He's really getting the brunt of it here. And look at Patrick Knowles in the background. Yeah, he did it. He's the one. But you see all this? Bud and Lou aren't here. It doesn't matter. The story is so strong, it's so compelling, that it could be a movie on its own without Bud and Lou. Okay,
right.
Here's Juliet, and Bud's on his game.
You got Spain to do, Lucy.
Okay, here comes William Milton Parsons, who usually played coroners and people who worked in places where there are dead bodies. And Lou is sitting there. He thinks he's a dead body. He's obviously been now watch Lou. He runs in front of them to show he's alive. Hello, kid.
Never mind that.
He gave him the murder for a bonus.
Sager!
All right, so he's going through the purse. There's 57 convenient ways to murder a man. Cookbook. What do you mean? That was 57 ways to cook a guy's food. It's a hobby of a lot of people. There's so many channels on television now. Real life murders, real life crime. They show you everything but the murder itself. And if they could, they would. Okay, here we go. The culprit and the murderer. They kind of repeat this in Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer. Okay. Now, I love this now. Is this where they gamble to go in?
I'm blanking, but I think it is.
Yeah. So what? He's the killer. So what? You got to capture him. So long. We'll gamble for it. This is great. Take a number. 4. No, you're wrong. Go on in. And of course, Lou's got to try it now.
No, give me a chance to ask you a number. You take a number.
Number 2.
Watch Lou's face. Sorry, there's genius there, folks. He just told us 9,000 things. And again, it's that click. Three expressions.
That click response, you know, just straight face and just that little.
That little. Yeah, I love that. So now they are meeting up with the real detectives, not knowing that they really are detectives. Look how much taller Bill Gargan is over Lou.
Sergeant! Certainly!
Now watch Lou. He compares his clothes. That is such an ad lib. I'm so sorry, but he looks at his tailor's work and then he looks at his cheap suit. And it's so subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Answer the phone.
Hello?
Now, in our original chapter, or episode 10, I mentioned how Lou is so much like Bugs Bunny. Now, why? It's because he becomes different things at different times, and he uses different things as different things. Like just before, he went to an electrical box and pretended it was a telephone and was talking into it like a telephone. Later on, they're chasing him, and he passes the elevator boy. He takes the elevator boy's hat, puts it on, and he's the elevator boy. You know what I mean? It's all Bugs Bunny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that Bugs Bunny became sort of a semi-regular on their radio show. Mel Blanc playing actually Bugs Bunny.
Hiya, fatso.
You know, it was so much fun to hear him. Okay, now here's the transcription scene. And when we were kids, we would roll on the floor from this.
A beautiful death.
And of course, that's Edmund McDonald, that same murder at midnight. Mm-hmm. All right, so he got shot right in the back. And he hits the other transcription record. I like this guy's voice.
Maybe this knife will.
So he's stabbed in the heart, shot in the back. Now he knows it's a culprit. And he hits another. Do you have halitosis? You know what's funny about that? When I was a kid, and I don't know about you, Jerry, I didn't know what halitosis was. But it didn't matter.
No.
Because I knew it was something that was totally off, you know, charts. And now he's going to get run over by a train.
And it's just a funny word, you know, halitosis.
Halitosis. Oh, no, it's great. The beauty of Lou Costello. He's a child. They cut his legs off. Look at the way I have to walk. Oh, God. Oh. The halitosis guy insulted him. I like the way Lou says, see? And then realizes. Okay, this is the killer. He's lurking. This guy's lurking. And there's Dr. Merrick, Ludwig Stossel. Oh, he's a kind old gentleman. Okay, lights went out. And there's mayhem afoot. Bud turns on the lights. Where's Mervyn? He's in the closet.
What are you doing in here?
I'm looking
for clues. In here? Ain't this the clues closet?
Ain't this the clues closet? And after the groan, we get on with the film. And this is just so, look at him. He's stabbed in the heart, hanging there. And Lou hangs his hat on the knife. It's funny and gruesome at the same time.
Yeah.
Right out of cartoons, right out of Warner Brothers. Crashing through the glass doors with the perfect silhouette, even his hat brim.
Yes.
Perfect. And you hear him crashing through more. And Bud following him. And it ends with Lou embedded into the wall. Now, look at the sound, the suction. and the pop. I was trying to make an impression. Oh my God. That is so funny. He's hanging around outside, inside. I love when Lou imitates people. Okay. So they're taking the real detectives as Ludwig Stossel is being taken out. So Bud and Lou's look bad at this point. And there's Juliet, her best side. Mary Wicks, working from the early 40s all the way up into the 1990s, if you remember her in Nonsense, the movie.
Sister Act.
Sister Act, right. Sorry.
Yeah.
I mixed up my nun things.
And I think her last was voicing a character in Disney's Hunchback as well.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I think that was after Hunch.
Yeah. I'm not sure, but I've got a hunch.
Yeah. From way back. Okay. William Bendix is showing how proficient he is at being an idiot. Now, the thing about William Bendix, not only was he Lou's best friend in Hollywood, but he could go from funny to deadly, villainous, to, you know, best friend of Alan Ladd in a film noir. He could do anything. And he was making movies for Hal Roach at this time. Hal Roach got the idea that he wanted to make shorter films to go with the feature films rather than two full movies as a double feature. So this is one of his worst ideas, Hal Roach. And the movies were like 40 minutes long, and they usually starred William Bendix and an annoying young guy by the name of William Tracy, who had this annoying high voice, and it's the reason I can't watch those movies. But anyway, so Bill Bendix could do anything, and he was a wonderful actor, just a wonderful actor. Okay, so here we are. I love this office set, by the way. And there's Patrick Knoll's shoes. You know, I have to say that when I used to talk to Patrick Knoll's, I had the nerve to express that I was a fan. And I had mentioned Robin Hood, because he was in Robin Hood. He was a good friend of Errol Flynn's. And that he played Will Scarlet. And his costumes were so outlandishly colorful. Yeah, I mean, he looked like one of the village people, you know? And we had a laugh about that because he was made fun of for years afterwards. Now, we're coming up to a fascinating part of this movie. Yeah, you guard the door. There was a cut sequence in this movie, and it's coming up soon. But now Lou thinks it's the transcription record again. Hi, boy. About halitosis? Okay. Now there's the big fight. And Juliet's going to help by grabbing some records and smashing them over the killer's head. And she gets Lou instead. And Lou is out. And you see this graphic, right? Now, this was supposed to lead into a dream sequence where Juliet is actually Juliet from Shakespeare, and Lou is dressed as Romeo, and he wants to go up on the balcony, and he's got a ladder, and they do this shtick where he's trying to climb the ladder, but he's pushing it into the ground, so he's not getting anywhere. It just keeps going down and down and down. And then Bud comes in, and they start a duel, and Lou hurts his head, and that's where he wakes up here. After the dream sequence. Now, they didn't throw anything away, and they used that stuff, the climbing the ladder and the ladder going into the ground, in their very next film, It Ain't Hay. So we get to see it, but not where it really should have been. I don't know why they cut that. It's such a great idea. I also have to say, Buck Private's Home, they cut a dream sequence, and it was also Romeo and Juliet, and it might have been the same thing, for all we know. Anyway. So here we go.
I think it was because, sorry.
No, go. Please.
I was going to say it's because Shakespeare's agent was so good they couldn't get the rights, you know. Romeo and Juliet, you know, never mind.
Yeah, right. They were waiting for a salesman to come to their house, you know, Avon calling. Never mind. So Avon, of course, Sebastian Cabot was the beard of Avon. So here they are going into the elevator. Ha, 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 ha. And of course, the elevator just goes insane. I love the bouncing and just the sound here. Can you imagine? That one. Bang, 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 bang. Oh, this is amazing. It just stops. And it didn't seem to affect Bud at all.
No.
Look at that fall. He is just wonderful. I used to practice that fall. Oh, my God. My stomach. Okay. Now, here they are backstage. Now, I'm assuming, you know, this is still the radio building. But why there's vaudeville, you know, on stage, this is just kind of weird. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Because the name of the act on stage are the Flying Bordellos. And how they got that past the censors is totally beyond me. The Flying Bordellos. You know? Go figure. Okay, so now we cut to our young lovers, who are really young detective lovers. Not that they love detectives, but they are lovers and acting as detectives. Stop me, Jerry, before I make myself a complete idiot.
Too late.
My point being here that we really don't mind this at all. We don't mind getting away from the craziness for just a few moments to catch up on the strong plot.
Mm-hmm.
And we're leading up to the a great finale. Now, look at this. This is the code he needed to figure out for the government. I am a flop as a detective. Okay, this is where they're finding out about Colonel Andrews and his connection with the government and that he was a great code expert. So it's all coming together. You will. I love this. They're going to reveal the murderer live. Over the radio, over the network.
Of course.
And of course. What a great idea. All right, so here come the Flying Bordellos in their Flying Bordello outfits. Even Bud's dressed as a Flying Bordello. Lou shows off his flair for languages. And here they are, flipping and flopping. Hey, you shut up! And there they go. Bud keeps going. But Lou has to pretend he's one of the Flying Bordellos. So the audience isn't on to him. Oops. And there goes Lou, landing in the chair with one person holding up this man who's like 230 pounds. Yeah. And look at the audience. Oh, the man's going to break his neck. Isn't that fun? And of course, Bill Gargan is on the seesaw. Drop him, drop him. And that sends Bill Gargan all the way up into the wings, not the wings, the flies, where he's stuck on one of these sandbags. Spread out, boys. And Bud is hiding. I just love that Lou becomes an acrobat, and he thinks he is.
Yes.
Look at him. He's creating mayhem. He's creating havoc. Yet he's taking bows. He's pushing people out of the way so he could take the bows. I love this. I just love this. And there's the fall. He's incredible. Just incredible. Okay. So now Bendix has to get Gargan down off the sandbag. So here they are, the second comedy team in the movie, and then Bill Bendix goes up while Gargan goes down. This is the Oliver Hardy moment. All right, now, I love this now. Lou takes over. He is now the supreme flying bordello, and he's going to do the most amazing stunt ever. Three grown men on the teeter-totter. Lou, another amazing pratfall, is going to jump on the end and send all three men into the arms of the one guy waiting on the end.
Yes! The one guy is expected to catch three, yeah.
Exactly. Now, I love how Lou explains it to the audience in pantomime. Three guys. Boom! Here we go. This is going to be an amazing stunt. As he goes, he breaks through the floor. I think he met the same guy at the end of Go West. You know,
yes.
Or might have met him down there. And of course, Lou pushes everyone out of the way and takes a bow for being an idiot. Look at him. And watch Lou try to get in with the doors, the painted doors. He tries to go up the steps. That is so great. And there's Bud ready. He's already changed. He's not a bordello anymore. I always liked this. Even when I was a kid, Bud's an angel, which is like opposite day. And Lou's a cherub, as he should be. Look at him. Oh, we thought that was naughty when we were kids. And here's my favorite truck joke.
Yes.
Trucking. Where'd you go? Mervin. In the truck. 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 So Lou starts trucking. Very popular dance from the mid to late 30s all the way up to now. And here we go with the routine that is one of the funniest put on film, is the telephone call. So $10,000. I mean, you could buy three houses at that time.
Yes.
Mervin Q. Milgram. Some jerk named Mervin Milgram. Alexander 2222. Okay, now I want to mention something about the writing here. Okay, we had a new writer for them, Stanley Roberts, who mostly wrote Westerns and actually Ritz Brothers movies before he got to this. He came up with the original story. But anyway, what my point being, drop a nickel, that this bit is just so perfectly interpolated into this movie. But the point of it is, this is the best one, the best version of it that they did. They've done this on the Colgate Comedy Hour, which was absolutely hilarious. Lou is ad-libbing all over the place. They do it in their film television show. But this is the best one, and I'll tell you why. In those other versions, he just needs to make the phone call, and he's frustrated because he can't. In this one, he's got 5 minutes. Right. To do it. Otherwise, he loses $10,000 and the little radio, of course. But it changes everything. It gives it more at stake, and it's funnier. But Lou just can't, he just can't cut a break. And the funny thing is, the place is right across the street. The place he's calling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, so the gag here is that everybody gets service immediately and Lou can't get arrested, you know. Look at him. See, 5 minutes. Look at him. He's got 5 minutes. What's the weather here? I don't know. I don't live here. I guess that was a logo or a company thing, you know. We work while you sleep.
Yep.
Boy, operators are a thing of the past, you know?
Oh, yeah.
They went the way of the busy signal and long-distance service and all that stuff. Okay, Bud's going to show him how easy it is. Give me Alexander 2222. Hello, is this Alexander 2222? Thank you. Bud's no help at all. I gotta go back and drink my coffee. My favorite one is coming up. The lady who sings opera,
mm-hmm.
and Lou joins her. This is one of my favorite Lou Costello moments of all time. It goes from him singing with her to him totally losing himself in it and then full on walking into the side of the wall of the telephone booth. It's the perfect punch to this bit. All right, let's watch this. Five minutes. I love how Lou gets wrapped up in it. There are a few perfect things in this world. That was just one of them.
Yep.
Look at him. Sound, sound. I'm all wet. How many times do I want to do this when I'm put on hold and, you know, nowadays when you can't get a person?
Yep. Yep.
Boy, she got it right in the eye. Lowered down to her mouth. Okay, so now they have to get into the building across the street. But the detectives and the cops are there waiting for them. This used to frustrate me when I was a kid. $10,000. Okay, I love this because not only is it a great gag that they walk in backwards and say they're walking in, which is brilliant, but it shows the teamwork that's too seldom later on. You know what I mean? Look at them. They were kids together. That's what we get. Even later on, when they're during the finale, when Lou is trying to walk on the wires, Lou says, "Remember when we were kids? You know, you used to walk on the cracks in the sidewalk." I like that. I like that they have a past. They're definitely a team. And you just saw Lou do Bugs Bunny,
grabbing
the guy's hat, and he became the elevator operator. Listen to the music. Mr. Smith, still glorifying it. Still, I used to do that, by the way. Still glorifying in Buck Privates and the amazing success of Buck Privates. He can't spell his last name. Give me the $2 question. He has no ID except the Campfire Girls, troop number 34. Here's our check for $10,000. Look at Peekaloo. Uh-oh, the cops are here. And a Play It Anywhere radio. Now watch how Lou decides what to give Bud. It's all done with weight. The radio is heavier, so he gives Bud the check for $10,000. No. This is meta, Abbott and Costello, commenting on their enormous popularity at this point. Anywhere. Wait a minute, copper. You know it's coming, but it's just so funny. It doesn't matter. He's just funny. He can't help but be funny.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. These guys are getting all ready because they are going to reveal the killer. Okay. John Grant is going to rear his ugly head again pretty soon with the handcuff routine. All right. You take the blimp. As if William Bendix is so thin, you know, by comparison.
Yeah.
They became best friends while making this movie. Robert Lees, the big liar. Spread the rumor that Lou didn't want Bendix in the movie, which is pure bull.
Yeah.
Now that was an interesting stunt. What time's the next feature? Come on. Okay. Now this is one of their favorite bits. They've done it. They did it with Charles Laughton in Captain Kidd. They did it with Mike the Cop on their film TV show. And they did it in Colgate Comedy Hour. I forget who they do it with. I can't remember. But anyway, they love this bit. That would hurt you because that's iron. Look how well they play together, the two of them. You can tell they're friends.
Yep.
Can you imagine sitting in a burlesque theater watching this routine, Lou Costello? It's just amazing. I've been watching on YouTube. Danny Thomas did a series of specials, hour-long specials in the mid-1960s, and have tributes to burlesque. And he trots out these burlesque routines, and he talks about all the great people he saw, you know, when he was a kid, and he was a candy butcher in the burlesque house where he grew up. So he got to see everybody. And, of course, he mentions everyone but Abbott and Costello. They're constantly given short shrift. I was going to say that also on YouTube are interviews with John Conti, who played the hero in Lost in a Harem. And he talks about working with Bud and Lou. And he's much older, of course, at this time. But what he remembers more than anything was their gambling. He said they would bring people in from Las Vegas to sit with them in their dressing room, and thousands of dollars would go back and forth, you know, and it was constant gambling, which I hate. You know, I hate to think about it because it's such a horrible habit, and the two of them were not good with money to begin with. Okay, so I have to say when Lou started fake boxing with Bill Bendix, as if he was like channeling Shemp Howard. You know, Shemp's boxing shtick. Mm-hmm. It's my favorite thing that Shemp does. Mm-hmm. Copping a sneak around me, eh? But Lou did his version of it, which is became his version of it. I also saw Larry Fine did it later on when Joe Besser was part of the Stooges, and you didn't have Shemp to go to.
Yeah.
Okay, so here, Juliet is going to help Bill Bendix, but not without promising to leave her boys alone. Look at that profile on her. She has absolutely no chin and a nose mm-hmm. you could play golf with, you know, if you held her by the ankles.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Don't worry. Okay, so here they are working it out that what Lou did was so humiliating to the cops that they're blackmailing them now. We'll tell what happened if you don't, you know, play along with us. So now they're getting Bud involved. Lou's getting Bud involved. He's dumber than me.
I'm warning you.
I love this. Excuse me. Look at him. Of course, with Captain Kidd, there was a little more at stake because he was ready to kill him.
Yes.
Whereas here, you know, we're just talking about arrest.
Get in there.
Watch, Bud. Uh-oh. Okay, now we're leading up to the grand finale as they're forced to do their idea of finding the killer during the broadcast. And I'm just looking at Louise Albritton's dimples.
Mm-hmm.
Yum. She was absolutely gorgeous. I'm going to say for the record that my favorite of the 1940s women, as far as beauty,
yeah.
Universal Studios, I think, had the cream of the crop. You know, you had beautiful women at the other studios, but, you know, person for person, I think Universal really had it down. You had Evelyn Ankers, Louise Albritton, Nan Wynn, Anne Gwynn, who rhymes with Anne Wynn, but never mind. But anyway, I love the Universal ladies, and I love Universal movies. They're unpretentious, they move quickly, and they're musical, and they're fun.
Yep.
Look at the lighting. Look at the lighting.
It's gorgeous.
It really is. Jerry, you took the word right out of my mouth. Of course, Lou's playing with his radio. And look at this. That was sort of like, this is our killer. Although he's pretty suspicious too, Joe Kirk.
Oh, yeah.
Here we go. There's Norman Abbott. I love that Lou, like a kid, he's going to try and listen to it on the radio while he's there live, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, it becomes the key to the whole thing. And look at the lady, the bored lady on the end. She's the screamer. And she's got nothing to do but scream.
Mm-hmm.
I always liked this. Even when I was a kid, I loved watching the radio actors work. That they read their lines, but they had to emote as they were reading the lines.
Yeah.
You know. And, you know, they probably had a quick rehearsal, but, you know, to me it's kind of amazing. And there he is,
Murder at Midnight.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, she's got a line. She didn't scream. That's nice.
One line.
Sometimes that's all it takes, my friend. There are no small parts, only small pairs of underwear. Ooh, he's a lady. Look how pretty she is. Not Jerome Cowan or Joe Kirk or Doc Porter. The rubber glove. Ah, they're pretty good writers. They wrote this in like, you know, a couple of hours.
Yeah.
I can't get that. He's got to plug it in. I love this. Okay, now we know who it is. Yes, you did. There is not a wall that he hasn't run into.
Yeah.
Oh, this is great.
Bud is so brave.
Yeah, he really is. In this movie, he really has his eye on the prize. He really wants to be a radio detective, you know, and this is going to get him there. I love that shot of Bud. I wish I had like a 8x10 of him like that. And I love this. Anything to avoid the cellar. And of course, going onto the rooftop, they don't realize that the killer is there. And he's got a gun. Why are you doing up here? You're supposed to be a son. Oops. And this starts the grand finale. Oh, look at that. Universal. I love Universal. Look at him.
Yeah.
All right, quick story. Don Porter absolutely loved working with Abbott and Costello. He absolutely loved it. He couldn't wait to get to work in the morning. Now, Don Porter was also part of a shooting group in Los Angeles where he was quite the marksman, a champion marksman. So when Bud has to have the bulb shot out of his hand, they had Don Porter do the shooting, the actual shooting. And he missed twice, I think, before he hit it the third time. But you got to give Bud credit for trusting Porter's aim, right? Now, I love this.
Yeah.
He has to pull himself up onto the building ledge. And what kills me is the shoe. He repeats this in Noose Hangs High when he's the window cleaner and he loses his shoe and he has to put it on. And Bud, man, he's there. There it was. He just shot it out. Apparently, Lou has trouble with ladders in this movie. This must be the latter part of the movie. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da. Oh, I love Universal. Did I say that? Look at this. Look at him.
Yeah, once or twice, yeah.
He is just incredible. Earl Kenton, what a director. There was one shot in this movie I forgot to mention. They're Bud and Lou are walking and talking in the hallway. And it's a panning shot. It's like a full minute that they're doing dialogue back and forth, and the cameras are you know, on a dolly, following them. And it's really complicated for a comedy, you know. But Earl Kenton really pulls it off. Yeah, Mervin. Now Mervyn gets this brilliant idea. I'll hit your nose off. We used to love that. I'll hit your nose off. So Townsend Phelps becomes Send Help. It's brilliant.
Yay.
Oops. Oops. He almost shot the most popular movie stars in America with his gun.
Look at this.
Excuse me. If there's something to run into, Lou will run into it.
Yep.
Okay. No more bullets. Lou's talking to us now.
So I'm stupid. You're a dummy. I ain't got no gun. Are you
I always thought that reading of the line was unusual. Are you sure of that? He put the emphasis on that. Whereas, yeah. Are you sure of that? Would be more natural, I think. Okay, so Bud's got him walking across wires. And he's like at the top of the Empire State Building, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a lunatic murderer, Nazi sympathizer with a knife at one end. And Lou's trying to slap him off like Joe Besser. Oops. Oh, when we were kids, Jerry, I'm sorry, but this was so exciting.
Oh,
this
yeah.
This is such a great finale. Look at that shot. Mm-hmm. You see the traffic moving below? The great Universal Miniatures Department. Look at this. Woo. And there's Bobby Barber. And I believe this is his first appearance with the boys. He was cut out of Hold That Ghost during that, you know, the whole waiter debacle scene. Yeah. Look at him. I love the way he slaps it shut. Watch him slap it. What's cooking? Watch. I wonder how he would have escaped if Lou didn't fall on him. I wonder how he would have escaped. I mean, not a good place to be on the roof.
No.
I think Lou had the right idea with the cellar. And Lou falls. And 230 pounds lands on John Porter. And it would have sent him through the floor, probably. Okay. Bud and Lou are the heroes. Which kind of describes this movie. Bud and Lou are the heroes. They are the focal point.
Yeah.
They don't need the Andrews sisters. They don't need... All right, let me tell you something. This was supposed to be a musical. It took place at a radio station. They were going to have the Andrews sisters and Phil Spitalny and his all-girl orchestra, an Hour of Charm orchestra with Evelyn and her magic violin. They were all set to be in this movie, and the powers that be, saner heads, said, no way, we're going to give Abbott and Costello their break. And they did. They proved that they could carry an entire film by themselves. And look at this. The light bulb bit. Help! And what a great ending. He throws the light bulb, and it just says end. What a wonderful movie. There was another ending shot, by the way, that they did not use.
And, really?
It was, and it's bad. I'm glad they didn't use it. This one was so much more clever, you know, turning send into end. But the original ending was going to be, he captures Don Porter. They take Don Porter away. And they're talking about, Patrick Knowles brings up the fact that there's something downstairs in a refrigerated room. Now, why there's a refrigerated room in a radio studio building, I don't know, but there's something down there that they need to investigate. But Lou trips and falls down one of those shafts that, you know, takes you all the way down, and you hear a crash and everything. Yeah. Everybody runs downstairs. They open up the refrigerator room door, and there's Lou totally encased in a block of ice. And that's the ending. Nope. Sorry. Not good.
No. This was so much better.
Yeah, but please. Maybe they were thinking of Hit the Ice, you know, coming later. But no, we got the good ending. And not only did we get the good ending, we got the great film. I put in to my AI assistant today, I said, what do you think the best Abbott and Costello movies are? Came right back with Hold That Ghost, Whodunit, and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. How about that? Now, the only one I didn't agree with was Hold That Ghost, which I love, but...
Yeah, I agree. I agree. It's for a top three, they definitely got two out of three. Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely. I just think Hit the Ice is funnier than Hold That Ghost. I think In Society is funnier. This one certainly is right up there. I always say that I love Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein more than any of the others, but this is a like half a hair below that, and not even half a hair, like a quarter of a hair, because it is a near perfect film and a near perfect Abbott and Costello film. So the writers and the producer, Alex Gottlieb, the director, Earl Kenton, the DP, Charles Van Anger, everybody was at the top of their game in this movie, and it really, really shows. Now, I'm going to put Jerry on the spot right now because it was his request to do the commentary on his favorite Abbott and Costello film, which happens to be this one, Whodunit. So, Jerry, since this was your original request to do the commentary on your favorite Abbott and Costello film, I just want you to wrap things up with it. I want to hear what your thoughts are, why it's your favorite, and, you know, just give us your overview, because I'd love to hear
from
you.
Sure, not a problem. I think I have shared on more than one occasion that this is my favorite of their movies because it is their movie. You know, when I watch an Abbott and Costello movie, yes, I love the Andrews sisters, and quite often the side story can be intriguing, but with this one, it's all them. And as we've pointed out during the commentary, the actual story of the film is very engrossing. It's just well put together, and it keeps you moving. And you don't mind that Bud and Lou are not on the screen.
Right.
And so it's like the perfect storm, in my opinion. And their energy level, it's, you know, early enough in their film career that they're still having fun. The supporting cast is just fantastic. I could watch Lou and Bill Bendix forever.
Yes, definitely.
And so yeah, it's just a perfect combination, a perfect blend of all the elements. And again, as you pointed out, it's gorgeous to look at. My gosh, the scenes in the studio are just with the shadows and, oh, it's beautiful. It's just a beautiful film.
I couldn't agree with you more. And like I say, it's their best, really. It's their best film that doesn't feature monsters. but I did want to mention just very quickly that this movie did have sort of a history. Alex Gottlieb, the producer, admitted to looking over Wheeler and Woolsey's movies from the 1930s and getting ideas for Abbott and Costello, you know, topics. Mm. And this one is based on a movie called The Nitwits, which is one of Wheeler and Woolsey's best films. And it takes place in a like a Brill Building type setting, songwriters instead of radio. And there's a murder and they have to solve the murder. And then 2 years later, Jack Oakey was in a movie called Super Sleuth. And he is a, you know, amateur detective trying to solve a murder. And then there is a remake of that by Irsat's Abbott and Costello, Brown and Carney, a movie called Genius at Work, which was their last film together. And that was Brown and Carney versus Bela Lugosi and Lionel Atwill. So there's really nothing to complain about. And my friend Ann Jeffries is in it as well. And she's just gorgeous as usual. So, yeah, so this had quite a history, and it works best with Abbott and Costello in Whodunit. Fabulous movie. Yep. Great choice, Jerry. And we'll have to meet again in a couple of weeks to record episode number 52 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. I do want to do a quick plug for the annotated Abbott and Costello, my book on the boys and their films, considered to be by almost every critic definitive, actually topping a book that was out about 35 years ago. Yeah, and we were glad to get on board and correct some of their mistakes and all of that. But anyway, that's here nor there. Jerry, thank you so much for spending time. And, you know, it wasn't exactly like twisting your arm to watch this movie again. You know? I actually could watch it again, like right now.
Yeah.
So that's how sick I am. And so let's meet for episode number 52. Let's think about what we'd like to do during episode 52. And we will get back to everyone. And just keep your eye out, because I post on my Facebook page. And if you're not on my Facebook page, please look it up. I will friend you. And I write jokes. I play songs. I do film history, whatever. It's a very entertaining page, so I'm told. And I'd love to have you there, because I do let you know about the podcast and what we're doing and what we're not doing. So do that, if you will. That would be great. If you want to know everything about me and my career and what I've done, go to www.nicksantamaria.com. And that'll give you all kinds of footage and some of the radio stuff I've done and, you know, just a lot of great stuff, a place to order my book. And Jerry, welcome home. I know you were doing some good work for a radio station that was trying to raise money.
Yeah.
How'd you guys do?
Yes. We came very close to achieving the goal, but the station manager was thrilled with the amount that we raised in the 2 days. So that's always a good experience. You know, you feel like you've accomplished something. You've helped
that's
out.
That's wonderful. Yeah, that's wonderful. And radio is such a dying medium that any plus I hear is fantastic, you know, because let's face it, radio is something we all grew up with, and it's something I just can't see being without, you know, completely. So anyway, Jerry, thank you so much for your time. And
thank you.
You're absolutely welcome. And everybody else, all of the fans of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, thank you for your constant support. Thank you for waiting for this one. I know it took a while to get here, but it was all for good reason. And I just want to say thank you for listening. And everybody have a wonderful 2 weeks before we come back again with more fun. Take care, everybody. I'm glad we found out who done it.